Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 7/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
You think you'd murder me, Joe?
Yes.
That's gruesome, Joe. That's horrible.
Yes, it is.
You don't blame me if I say I hope you never get out of this place.
I hope I never do either.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Hi, guys. Welcome back. Today's case is one that I've been forcibly made to do by my son. He was so horrified by an interview I have seen countless times that he said, you need to cover this, Mum, because I can't quite believe that people were allowed to interview individuals like this in prison, particularly when they were saying things like, yes, I would actually happily like to kill you. But in America, we all know that serial killers and other killers do often get interviewed, and it's why researchers have been able to do a hell of a lot of studying. So it's not a bad thing, but sometimes it's a pretty disconcerting thing when the interviewer is literally saying, do you want to kill me? The person who's the predator is going, well, yes, actually, I'd really like to kill you. So I have agreed to cover the Joseph Callinger case. It's also called the Shoemaker in the annals of true crime history. He was actually a serial killer who committed his crimes between 1974 and 1975. And probably what is the most horrifying about this case is that he also committed the crimes with his teenage son. When you think about daddy and Sundays, you don't necessarily think about popping out to create some kind of chaos, wreak havoc, and get involved in murderous intent. But it appears that Callinger didn't actually get the memo on that one, as far as being a father was concerned. Also, if you're new to my channel, I release my crime content twice a week. If you are subbed to me on Patreon or YouTube membership, you also get extra full-length videos there, and more are coming. So thanks to every single one of you who's helping me. I cannot do it without you. Let's talk about Joseph Callinger, because he didn't have an easy start to life, that goes without saying. So he's born in December 1936, and his parents were Judith Renner and Joseph Lee Brenner Jr. He was born to them in Northern Liberties Hospital in Philadelphia. Sadly, his father actually abandoned his mother, and we all understand that back in the days that we're talking about, back in the 1930s, it's very, very difficult financially for a single mother, full stop. It's really challenging if you happen to be in a scenario where all of a sudden you're bringing up a child by yourself. So in January 1937, she actually places him in a boarding home. He does actually still see his mother, but he only sees her once a week. And apparently he develops some really serious separation anxiety, which makes perfect sense. I'm sure you all understand what separation anxiety is, but when we look at the development of children, what we want to see is secure attachment. And secure attachment basically forms the basis of healthy, well-adjusted relationships. So when you have secure adjustment, it basically means that you're an individual who feels safe in your environment, but also acknowledges your primary caregiver or caregivers, and you want to be around them. And it's not that you can just go anywhere and do anything without any care or concern about what could play out as a child, is that you are aware that you have a safety net, and that's what really forms that really positive adjustment. Now, unfortunately, if you have a very sensitive temperament or an individual who genuinely is kept away from primary caregivers who you love for a period of time, because, for example, in this case, he's in a boarding house, separation anxiety can develop and it can really, really grow. So it can be something that becomes highly problematic. For most people, an example of separation anxiety just in its typical form will be you take your child to preschool for the first time and all of a sudden you realise that they're crying and they're anxious. And that's because they're in unfamiliar situations with new faces and it's scary. And there is a typical reaction in those consequences of experience. But if that is something that doesn't abate, if it doesn't go away, then understandably that's something more serious. And some children will endure that even with the most unpositive environments. But when we see severe separation anxiety, it can almost create a despondency, a helplessness, because the child realises there's nothing that they can do, that person isn't going to come back. So separation anxiety doesn't have to typically be represented by a child being hysterical or crying and seeming very upset. It can actually come across in the end as a child who's just completely disconnected. Now, at 2 years of age, his mother still can't find a husband, and that means she can't find a home for him. She can't find somebody that's going to be able to provide for them both. So unfortunately, he gets put on the Catholic adoption list. And you can perfectly understand that his mother thinks that she's doing the right thing here, but that's 2 years of change, transition, a level of dysfunction. So essentially, that's going to be something that's psychologically going to be impacting on him on a daily basis. And now he's going to have to go to a completely new home. And if he had gone to a really lovely home, which is what we expect, desire and wish for any child who's adopted, then I'm sure that the story I'm telling would have been slightly different. But that's not what happens. He's adopted by Austrian immigrants Stephen and Anna Kallinger. And at this point, he's adopted into a very abusive family, which is harrowing. It doesn't matter where we go in the world. It doesn't matter what time frame we live in the world. Predators of children, they exist everywhere. In every demographic, every ethnicity, every time frame and decade, they exist. And they're going to go about their business getting access to the thing that they want. And essentially going ahead and adopting a child that you're not really prepared to nurture and love is diabolical. But that's what happens to him. When he was 5 years of age, to put this into the context of abuse, he actually heard the F word from neighbourhood kids, which we all understand. We hear these words, we repeat these words, and we get into trouble with our parents because of it. He does that. He repeats the word. He ends up getting really badly beaten by both his mother and his father. He's grounded for a week. When he's six, he actually has to have a hernia repair. But the reason for that is because his father has caused that. So the hernia has been caused by his dad. Anybody who remembers the way that things used to be or has had any experience of history, when you look at the medical system, when you were a kid and we went to hospital to have an operation, you would be left by yourself. So it wasn't as if the environment itself in hospital was going to be warm and inviting. You would literally be separated from your parents and caregivers until you were well. And that again would have exacerbated his separation anxiety, because it feels like whenever he gets a footing or a grounding, something shifts and changes. Also, his parents, who are very abusive, they actually decide to tell him that the reason that he is having that surgery is to keep his, quote, bird small and make it not work. Now, sexualizing a six-year-old child is disgusting. It speaks to predatory individuals. It speaks to individuals who are warped in their mentality, and his parents clearly were. The idea that you would firstly put your child through an operation because you have caused the injury. Secondly,
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
find it funny to sadistically tell that child that terrible things are going to happen, i.e. his penis is not going to work anymore once he's had it, that says something about the way you like to humiliate children, the way you enjoy being predatory around children, and the way that that sadistic nature of yours obviously gets great pleasure from harming the most vulnerable in your world, in this case, a child. And then, I kid you not, just to add to what could only be considered a hostile environment, at the age of 6, let this sink in, he's 6, he's hit in the head by a hammer 4 times because his mother basically knew that he wanted to go on a class trip to the zoo. So I'm just going to throw it out there. Most parents' reactions, even if they haven't got the money, would just be a hard no. Others would just, I don't know, hand over the cash and say, have a good time, dear. Some would actually volunteer to go on the trip, but not Callinger's adoptive mother. No, she's like, you know what's going to happen to you? If you want to go on a normal standard class trip, I'm going to beat you around the head with a hammer. So we're talking the highest level of abuse. And another thing that they really seemed to enjoy doing was laughing at him. Any ambition he had, any dream he had, and children are full of them. Children are full of dreams, full of ambitions, full of hopes, full of aspirations. And you and I both know that when they go to school, often they feel really attacked by the academic system because, with respect, unless you're standing out in all your classes or sport, you're not necessarily that noticed. Parents, though, they see your fantastic acting. They watch you as you perform songs. They recognise your art. We as parents raise our children up. We see the things that are notable about them that others fail to notice. And that's what you need. And he has the direct opposite. And it gets worse. Because at 8 years of age, he's actually sexually abused. So this is when he's held at knife point by older boys. One of them performs oral sex on him. But you can imagine, can't you, this developing child going through all of these complexities and conflicts and abuses. It is warping who he is becoming. We get to when he's 11. At this point, he steals from his parents. And the reason for that is he wants to take his neighbours to the movies because he's desperate to make friends. He's really lonely. Now, understandably, not a good choice, Callinger, with your parents. However, what I would also know when we look at this kind of typical repetitive behaviour of children who are being abused, and we say to ourselves, well, why are they going ahead and doing things that are going to make things worse? Well, it doesn't, does it? At the end of the day, he got beaten around the head with a hammer for wanting to go on a school trip to the zoo. So that was just a typical request that any child should be able to make peacefully from a parent. The very fact that he steals money and takes people to the cinema and then obviously gets punished, and he does, he gets his fingers burned on the stove, he continues doing those things because, hey, he's going to get beaten anyway, he's going to get burnt anyway. May as well make some friends along the way to try to reduce that sense of isolation and abandonment that he's living on a daily basis. Now, it spirals. When he gets to teenagehood, things are really starting to become troubling. At 13 years of age, he literally cuts a hole in his wall, and that is to masturbate. Very atypical. We all appreciate those of us who've been blessed with boys in our lives that essentially, at times, as they say in the Bridesmaids movie, down the side of the bed, maybe socks or towels that essentially you could just crack in half. We get it. We know that developing young men are going to masturbate, as are young women. But what most of us are not experiencing in our world with teenagers is them going ahead and cutting some kind of hole in the wall to make some kind of glory hole experience in their own bedroom. It's a little bit worrying. Also, he's masturbating to naked pictures of men, naked pictures of women, but also he wants to have a knife nearby when he's doing that. So you can hear, can't you, the sadism coming into play, the way he's starting to get excited sexually by the potential idea of violence. And this is at 13. And then as he's going down this masturbation route where he's being quite sadistic in his fantasies, it's no longer enough. So he actually starts to only be able to become aroused when he's cutting and stabbing the pictures whilst he's pleasuring himself. Most people would never be like that. It's the argument about the pornification of our society. Don't get me wrong, I think the pornification of our society is a dreadful thing because the extremes that we see in pornography are genuinely chilling and they're not positive for women. Let's just be clear. However, most people are satisfied when they use porn with a very small spectrum. They don't need to exaggerate, amplify, go deeper and darker to connect themselves sexually with those images and fantasies that they have on screen and in their head. But some do. And that's what we're talking about with this guy. There is something about being titillated sexually that no longer is satisfying in what we consider the typical realm. And then at 13 as well, he starts hearing voices. And those voices, he says, are compelling him to cut someone. So he actually, at 13 years of age, gets on a bus. He's got a knife with him, and he just follows this child that he's basically identified as being alone. Joseph goes over to him, talks to him, but then he leads that little boy into the woods, orders him to take his trousers off at knife point. Now, he didn't actually harm the child. He ran away once he'd managed to get him to do that. But seriously, at this point, we have a child who is becoming a sexual predator. And over the next few months, he did it three more times. So we're seeing this escalation. Now, the last victim, a boy called Joseph, he actually was able to reenact exactly what happened to him. He was 8 at the time. And at that point, he actually said that he was orally raped, essentially, by Kellinger. And this was at knife point. And also, he bit his penis. So again, he's got this child in this awful situation, terrified, at knife point. And then he's orally raping him and he's biting him. So he's actually using that sadistic extra to harm him. Now he gets to 14 years of age and he meets Hilda. This is a girl that he starts dating. His parents are not happy, but that's because his parents are horrible human beings. His happiness is not something that makes them happy, quite the contrary. And they say, listen, we don't want you to see her. He actually ignores that because why wouldn't you? It's horrible for him, whatever. They're awful to him, whatever. So why not at least bring yourself a little bit of joy? Now, he actually moves out of the house at this point, but he does work at his father's shoe shop. And it seems that this would be a high point to some degree in his life because he's got friends for the first time. And he ends up dropping out of education and then starts working full time as a shoemaker. In 1953, he marries Hilsa. That's whom he's been with since he's 14. They actually had 2 children. But 3 years later, she leaves him for another man. And I understand why, because all you need to do research-wise regarding Kellinger is look at the kind of actions that he is capable of to know that the relationship would not have been peaceful, would not have been a nice place to be, and she left due to domestic violence, and he will have been hyper-violent. We get to when he's 21. Obviously, he's had 2 children. He's had a wife that's now left him. I'm sure that all the separation anxiety and stress and things that go with it will have exacerbated. And he actually gets hospitalized. Now, when they hospitalize him, they believe they're dealing with a suspected brain lesion, but it isn't. So it reveals when they do the test that he has a psychopathological nervous disorder. So it's not organic in the way that they'd consider initially. It's more of a psychopathological manifestation. So think about being affective psychotic, obsessive compulsive, having an impulse control disturbance. They would all fit into that particular issue. And clearly stress is an exacerbator of those things. When he's 22, he's on his second marriage. So he marries Elizabeth Baumgard. This demonstrates, again, an emotional immaturity. To have got married, to have been in a relationship where you've had 2 children, for it just to have ended, and then for you to meet somebody and marry again, demonstrates that you're not really thinking about the emotional integrity of the relationship or your reaction to that relationship psychologically. And it's not easy for Elizabeth, shall we say, because that very same year, he decides that it's probably going to be a good idea to set his own house on fire. Yeah, he just goes ahead, burns his house down. And the reason he did that was financial motivation. He got $1,600 from the fire insurance. But we all know that's something that puts other people's lives at risk. There are consequences to those actions. Clearly, he is not concerned about the impact on others. And that certainly demonstrates his mindset throughout the rest of his life. Also, when we think about people who start fires, we can look back to the McDonald triad psychologically. John McDonald created that triad. And one of those triad points is pyromania, a desire to set things on fire, is a destructive mechanism. Add to that animal torture, add to that bedwetting, that's the 3 that make up the triad. Although sadism is one that people would like to bring in as well. And certainly we're dealing with a sadist where this man is concerned. Now at 23, he actually tries to end his life. We all appreciate that's a terrible situation for anybody to be in, and he must have been in a desperate place. But arguably, whilst it's awful to say, for the rest of humanity, it would not have been a bad thing if he had succeeded. Because there is a sense there that he has a level of helplessness and hopelessness, and he has a understanding that there is something very fractured within him, and going ahead and trying to end his life, I genuinely think was about trying to end his pain as well as the potential pain of others, but he isn't successful. He then goes on and sets fire to his home twice more. This is when he's 29 and 31. So we're seeing this habit in his nature, and it also shows very low impulse control. And I suppose we can also think back to the tests that they do at hospital where it isn't something that's naturally organic, like a brain lesion, but there is something more psychological that's going on with him. Now, he ends up having 5 children with his second wife. And essentially, from the very beginning, he is highly abusive. The fact that he has gone through the abuse in his own childhood has not deterred him. It is a pattern now within his own behaviour. He is an individual himself who is quite comfortable being deeply abusive. And the fact that he's harming his own children in the most horrendous of ways just does not affect his conscience. His oldest daughter once runs away from home because she's had enough. What does he do when she gets home again? He brands her with a hot iron as punishment. Now, we all know in this day and age, if you did that, you'd lose all your kids immediately, and rightfully so, because it's a highly dangerous action as a parent to do that. Also, what does it tell you? Psychologically, I own these children. You're branding something because they're a possession, not because they're an autonomous human being themselves. We get to 1972, and at this point, he's arrested on child abuse charges. Why? Because 3 of his children go to the police station and basically say, our father is abusing us. So his daughter, Mary Jo, she says to the police that her father threatened her with a knife, that he beat her regularly, he often tied her up, he burned her on the buttocks with a hot spatula. His sons, Joey and Michael, they said that their dad would tie them up to radiators. And bear in mind, if you're being tied up to a radiator, and this is back in the day, those radiators get to scalding. I'm sure that some of you, like I did, have went to very, very old schools, whether that's a primary school or a secondary school, and you will remember in the winter, if you happen to have a desk next to those great big radiators, you would want to move away from them because it's nice to be warm, but it's not nice to feel like you're literally in a sauna wearing a pullover, which is what it was like at school. But they are dangerously hot. It's as simple as that. So to tie them to the radiators, on one level, you've got the when it's cold, you're just being restrained. But on the other level, you're getting burnt because of that. Also, he beat them with hammer handles and with strips of leather. So this is high level sadistic abuse. Also, a neighbour goes ahead and complains and says, listen, this is true. This is absolutely true. Callinger is unhinged because the previous Sunday to the children's complaints, Callinger had actually arrived at the house where the children were actually just innocently playing and threatened that particular person who was putting up with the kids at that point, had invited them into the home to play with their children, threatened him with a pistol and ordered his kids home. Now, the children at this point are taken to hospital, and it's obvious to the medics that what they're saying is true because all of the injuries were consistent with their claims. Police then go to the home, and Callinger and his wife just say, it's all lies, I've done none of this, these allegations are completely untrue, and the children actually got these injuries when they ran away. Now, we all know people don't always get taken seriously, and with respect, in this case, that could have been the way it played out, but it didn't. The children were believed. Callinger was arrested, and it is very disheartening, isn't it, when you see that the woman he was with, the mother of the children, did have an opportunity at that moment in time to say, actually, what the children have said is true, and to essentially seal his fate, but she wasn't willing to. Now, that could have been financial, because Callinger's bringing in a wage. It could have been because she was emotionally controlled, but essentially, she abandons the children's needs by not agreeing that what they have said is true. Now, he is then placed in custody. At this point,
step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. Also, they measure his IQ. So it was measured at 82. Average human being has an IQ of 100, which is really bright. 82 is a low average. So it's not really low, it's just a low average. And Callinger's actually found at this point completely competent to stand trial after they've done the psychological examination, which to some degree surprises me just on the basis that they said that he's been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And clearly that is a high level issue that is very problematic for many people to manage. But at the same point, if he seems like he's consciously understanding what's going on around him, they're going to find him competent. In August 1972, understandably at this point, he is found guilty of child abuse. He was actually sentenced to 11 months imprisonment. He'd already served 7 months at that point, so he's then given 4 months probation, and he also had to undergo mandatory psychiatric treatment. Sadly, in February 1973, what happens is the children, all three of them, those who testified against the dad, end up signing affidavits to the court, and they say that all of the charges that were brought against the dad were fabricated, that they were all false. Now, we automatically all know that that's because they were clearly forced into doing that. So imagine your primary caregivers just saying to you, you're not going to get fed, you're not going to get looked after, terrible things are going to happen to you unless you take back everything that you've said. It's going to be really challenging not to go ahead and do that. The police do absolutely believe they were coerced. They interviewed them at length, but at this point, they absolutely refused to be swayed. So sadly, Callinger's conviction squashed, his records cleared, and that means that no further action was taken. Bear in mind, he was meant to have mandatory psychiatric help at this point. It is not good that this has all been quashed. Now, following the assertion that the children essentially had fabricated the story about their father, Callinger's son, Joey, he's called Joseph Jr. in fact, he ended up getting sent to a reform school. And one of the reasons for that is allegedly down to the fact that he was having some homosexual involvement with an older man. It is so deeply messed up, isn't it? It is so scary, ultimately, that these days we are completely at peace with people being able to love who they love. But in those days, literally, it could end up having you sent to a reform school if you happen to be sexually interested in the gender that you belong to. Now, understandably, the fact that this is a teenager and there is an older man, that also speaks of grooming. It also is about inciting a child to act in a sexual way illegally with you. But like I said, nobody cared, because if you were considered a gay boy or man, you were at risk of being imprisoned, at risk of being sent to mental health units. My uncle, for example, who came out as gay at a time where it was illegal in the UK, was basically told he should have ECT. These are things that have changed in present day, but back then were very pertinent to the experience. So clearly we've got Joseph Jr. who is struggling because people believe they have a right to question who he is sexually, but also because he's probably been going through some kind of sexual abuse and grooming. Now, when he's at the reform school, they evaluate him as seriously disturbed. He gets released after 6 months. That's in May 1974. You think to yourself, well, is that the actual whole of it, that he ended up being seriously disturbed? What was the treatment? What was the plan for him? If there was something seriously amiss about this child, what were they going to do to help him? It's no good just assessing him as seriously disturbed and letting him go. How can they reach in and help this child? So clearly, Joseph Jr. is really struggling. And then in the same year, Callinger actually told his 12-year-old son, Michael, that he had been ordered by God to murder young boys and to sever their genitals. And that in itself is a truly traumatic conversation for your father to have with you as a child. Nobody wants to have their dad come over to them and say, you know what I'm feeling? I'm feeling that God's been talking to me. We just have to go out, murder some people, affect their genitals in a really badly way. Ideally go for kids. No one wants to hear that. But bear in mind as well, we have these highly dysfunctional relationships. We have a child who is incredibly scared of his father, but arguably probably would like a relationship with his father. And suddenly his father is saying, well, this is the information I've been given from God and I would really like your help. And it's really challenging to turn that down, because it gives you a direct connection with your father and it means that you're going ahead and helping him out, and that gives you a sense of pride and acceptance. And even though it is so warped psychologically, emotionally, on every level. Nonetheless, you can kind of see those threads of connection. And they go ahead. The pair begin a crime spree in July 1974. So first of all, they murdered this little boy, Puerto Rican child, 9 to 10 years of age, a guy called Jose Collazo. And with that killing, they didn't just murder him, they tortured him brutally. They did indeed cut off his genitals. His body was actually found on the 7th of July, 1974. It was found in an abandoned factory in Kensington, and he had been suffocated. He had been sexually mutilated, and they don't know who did it because Callinger hasn't been somebody who has stood out for crimes like this. He isn't on their radar, so he isn't formally connected to the crime. It actually only comes about that he admits the crime when he's later confessing for other killings. But this child has been murdered and mutilated in the most horrendous of ways, and indeed in the way that he's told his son God is telling him to do so. Then Callinger takes out some really problematic insurance. He takes out a $45,000 life insurance policy on two of his sons, Joey and Michael. Shortly after, Joey goes missing, just disappears. 2 weeks later, in August 1974, Joey's found dead. He's found in an old building in Philadelphia. He's found under rubble at a demolition site. The coroner said that it looked like his body had been partially crushed by machinery. They could not determine the death. Detectives are not stupid. They're looking at Joseph Callinger. They're thinking to themselves, this guy took out $45,000 life insurance on his children and one of them disappears and is found dead only weeks afterwards. And when it comes down to family killings, there is passion and there is finance that tend to be the two main players. In this case, financial gain seems to be the motivation. And the insurance company are not stupid. They certainly are not dealing with their first rodeo where a fake claim is concerned. So they actually refuse to honour Callinger's claim. And down the line again, when he's incarcerated, he did admit that he drowned his own son. Isn't it horrific to see how this man literally sees his children as property, from branding his daughter to taking life policies out on his children to murder a child to try to get that cash? It is so disturbing because it demonstrates an absolute lack of connection between parent and child. Now, 2 months after Joey's death, guess what? His brother Michael, he's just found wandering the streets. He's really dazed. He's really confused. He's got multiple head injuries. Callinger at this point speaks to the police when they say, we've found your child. He's very badly injured. And he says, oh, he's just fallen down. Michael, bear in mind, has been beaten so badly and sustained really serious injuries. He has no idea how he's got his injuries. So he cannot verify whether what he said as a father is true or whether indeed he's been attacked by Callinger. Now, police believe without a doubt Callinger has tried to kill Michael for the insurance money. And what Callinger does in that moment is get really angry. He basically says, how dare you? How dare you suggest that when I've lost one child in the most horrendous of circumstances, and basically the insurance haven't paid out because they're directing blame at me, that you are now trying to do the same with my other son? You know, I've gone through this horrendous period of trauma, and here you are trying to make out that I'm some kind of predator. So he actually files a lawsuit against the police in court, and he says, they're harassing me, they're harassing my family after I've just lost my son Joey. And court were actually on Callinger's side. They said that the police interest in Callinger was unwanted, and the police were basically ordered to drop the case, which is just devastating, isn't it? Because they were 100% right, and they knew they were 100% right, and yet here they are in a situation where the courts are saying, but out. You can't go near this family again. And that gives Callinger a kind of carte blanche, laissez-faire attitude towards his actions and bolsters his confidence, without a doubt. Now, shortly afterwards, this is in November 1974, Callinger and his son Michael, they actually break into occupied homes because what they want to do is they want to rob and they want to terrorise the people who live there. It's a mutual experience where they're being very sadistic with the residents and terrifying them, but they're also benefiting financially because they're stealing from them. And they actually broke into homes in Lindenwood, New Jersey. And they broke into one home on one occasion when no one was in, But then when they broke into another, Joseph Callinger sexually abused the woman who was there. So his crimes are escalating on a sexual level, and he now has his accomplice in his son. We get to December 1974. Again, the pair do something that is extremely dominating, extremely sadistic. They kidnap four women. They actually manage to steal $20,000 worth of valuables and cash, which is a huge amount of money. And they robbed, assaulted, and actually sexually abused four families on that rampage. That is absolutely overconfident on every level. And there is clearly not a level of organisation to the way that they act. Yes, they're effective at randomness, which means it's more difficult to pinpoint who these people are who are doing these things. But certainly just the amplification and escalation of the crimes is very much in context with what we see in disorganised criminals. They think they're clever, they think they've got it covered, but really they make a hell of a lot of mistakes. Now, on the 8th of January, 1975, when Callinger is on this crime spree, he takes 13-year-old Michael. That's how old his son is, 13. He takes him from his home in Philadelphia, and together they take a bus to New York. Now, from there, they travel to Fort Lee, New Jersey, and then they walk to the neighbouring town of Leonia. Now, Leonia in New Jersey is a small town. It's only got 9,000 residents at this point. So, understandably, if there's only 9,000 residents in an area, you're going to notice people who stand out because of strangers. So they do. They notice people who are not familiar to them. A local postman, a guy called Salvatore Tufo, he sees them walking along Wells Avenue just before 11 a.m. He said one of the things that stood out for him was they were just walking really casually. It wasn't as if they had any purpose. And one of the things that he noted was they were scanning the houses as they went. He also said that he found it a little bit disconcerting about the way they were with one another, because he's talking about a 13-year-old teenager and the father, but they're holding hands and occasionally they'll cuddle each other. He described it as strange and almost effeminate. And then another local, somebody called Lucy Befaqua, she noticed the pair just past 12 p.m. She was basically looking out of her window. She was on Glenwood Avenue. And she actually described the boys' actions as, quote, offensively effeminate. Now, in this day and age, we would suggest that the characteristics that child was giving off was of a camp nature. And that's something that in our modern society, we don't even blink at. It's just part of certain individuals' character and personality. And some people are more camp than others. It doesn't necessarily even indicate that that person has homosexual interest. It's just the way that they act. But in this case, and at this time, those words offensively effeminate are to do with a time frame where being gay was considered shameful. It's awful, and yet those kind of viewpoints genuinely existed. So that's what she notices, that he's just very effeminate, and it stands out in her mind. Now, she leaves her house. She returns around 3:20 p.m. Her own daughter arrives back about 10 minutes later. Now, shortly after, Lucy goes out to check her mailbox. And at this point, she is stunned because her neighbour from across the street, a woman called Edwina Romaine, she hops out of her front door and she is screaming. She is hysterical. Lucy, understandably, goes over and sees her neighbour. And she said that Edwina was just literally babbling something about a killer. She couldn't really make it out. Edwina at this point says, please, Lucy, can you untie my feet? Because they're actually bound together with a thin cord. But Lucy is not processing in that moment. All she knows is a woman has ran out who's familiar to her, is saying that somebody is being killed. Looks like she's been tied up and restrained to some degree. So she runs straight home and rightfully calls the police. Although it would have been ideal, Lucy, if you'd firstly untied Edwina, who is clearly in a situation of threat. But we all act in different ways in those fight, flight or freeze moments, don't we? Now, Edwina Romaine had three children. She had twins who were 21, Randy and Retta. They lived with her at home. Her oldest child, Dee Dee, was married. She was married with children of her own. So what had actually played out was on the 8th of January, where Callinger and his son are out on the rampage, essentially. Edwina's older daughter, Dee Dee, had actually gone over to Edwina's house on Glenwood Avenue. And the reason for that is because she has an ailing grandmother and she wants to make sure that whilst her mother and sisters are out, she is present. When she gets to the house, she looks out of the window and she sees a man and a boy approaching. So as you would, you go to the front door, you ask them what they need or want. The man identifies himself at this point as John Hancock, says he's a salesman. He then says, is anybody else in the house? And Dee Dee was really spooked by his demeanour and she said, no, and can you please go away? Didn't go well. Immediately she's grabbed by the man and then he forces his way into the home. So her absolute world was just crumbled in that moment. Now Dee Dee tried hard, she fought back, but he gets a gun out, he gets a revolver. So she now knows that her life is at risk. Now this disturbance means that Dee Dee's 4-year-old son, who was with her that day, comes through into the room. He's seeing the struggle playing out. He starts screaming. At this point, the gun's turned on him. The man who's assaulting them says, this is a robbery. Do as I say, you won't get hurt.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
He then orders Dee Dee not to look at me, keep your eyes shut, he says. He then says, is anybody else in the house? Dee Dee obviously says, yes, my invalid grandmother is in the home. He pushes Dee Dee and Robert at this point up the stairs to the grandmother's bedroom. Now, Callinger then says to Michael, check on this woman, see whether she is indeed an invalid. Michael confirms, yes, she is. Callinger then pushes Dee Dee into a vacant bedroom. He gags her, he wraps tape around her face, he covers her eyes and mouth, which I think must be ultimately terrifying. He then says to her, take your clothes off. Now she refuses. I have to give it to her. She is a really brave girl, because very often in these situations, people will comply because they fear not doing, but there she is fighting, there she is refusing. She doesn't have the power, she doesn't have the opportunity to actually resist him in a way that is going to make a physical difference in that circumstance, but emotionally, she is not giving in. He then undresses her. He says, is anyone else going to come home? She says, yeah. At this point, he takes her jewelry off, he ties her hands behind her back, he ties her elbows and her ankles together, he binds them together with electrical cord, and Callinger is yelling out to Michael to go and check the front doors locked. Callinger then strips her little boy, Robert, so he's naked as well, and lies him on the bed next to her. Now, according to Dee Dee, Callinger actually rolls her onto her back and then tries to force her legs apart, and he's apparently absolutely alarmed because she's on her period. So he physically removes her tampon and then throws it on the floor, apparently in disgust, which is so ironic when you are literally holding an entire family to ransom and you are trying to assault them in every way that's grotesque, and yet her being on her period is something that upsets you. Shortly after this, because the door's been closed and locked, the doorbell rings. Dee Dee's sister, Randy, she's come home. She's really surprised that the door's locked. It's not a time and place where that would usually be the case. But she's even more surprised when a man, a stranger, opens the door and then drags her inside. He's got a gun pointing at her head. She's then told by him it's a robbery, that she's got to do exactly what she's told. He tells her again, keep your eyes closed, and he pushes her up the stairs. He demands money. She actually gave him $5 at this moment in time. She's then taken to the bedroom where Dee Dee and Robert are naked on the bed. She sees them, and then Randy is absolutely distressed. She's panicking. She thinks maybe they've been murdered. And they actually have to allow her to go and check that they are both breathing before she can actually stop with the hysteria. Understandably, she can't quite believe or compute what is playing out. He then asks for money. She says there's some in the dresser. She again is ordered to strip. She's then asked, is anyone else coming home? And she said, yes, there'll be lots of people. He then binds her. Then he discovers that she too is also on a period. And he says, what's this? And leaves the room. So he's really annoyed that they are going through that natural process. It's obviously something that deters him a little sexually from these women. Now the doorbell rings again. That's because Edwina has returned home with her daughter, Retta, and her boyfriend, Frank Welby. So Callinger answers the door. Again, orders them inside with a gun. Can you envisage just how many people he's in control of in this moment? I mean, he is just confident, isn't he? Person after person, he's just controlling with this gun, telling them what to do. And he basically says, you do as you're told, you won't get hurt. They're then ordered to the living room. They're forced to lie down. He takes their jewellery. He gets them bound and he gets the Venetian blind cord to do the feet of the woman. Callinger is then holding a gun at Frank's head the whole time because obviously Frank is a man, so he could pose a problem. And Callinger binds Frank's hands with his own belt. He then orders his son to bind the woman's hand with a vacuum cord. He did tie Retta, but he really had problems with Edwina. Callinger said, "Don't bother with her. She's too old to do anything anyway." Yes, that was a bit of an underestimation. I think you'll find it was Edwina who is the person who raises alarm. But nonetheless, it's good to be underestimated, isn't it, chaps? So the pair then leave the room. Again, they're looking for valuables. At this point, there is another knock at the door, and it's actually Edwina's 21-year-old neighbour, who's a nurse, Maria Fashing. Now, she's a practical nurse. She lived in the neighbourhood, and she was coming to look in on Romaine's invalid mother. She's again herded into the living room. She's forced to lie down. Now, like I said, there is a man here, Frank. So that's going to be the person that Callinger believes is his biggest threat. So with Frank, he's gagged him, he's bound tape around his face, he's hogtied his hands to his feet. Frank is barely able to move. He's then ordered to the basement where his pants and underwear are pulled down to his knees. So this is very much a humiliation ritual, isn't it? He wants to sexually abuse each person in some way, to some degree, pulling the trousers down of a man, demasculating him in such a way when he would normally want to protect those around him, making sure the girls are all naked, just making them feel really exposed and vulnerable. It's obviously very titillating for him. Also, where Frank's concerned, a knife gets held against the base of his penis and he is warned, if you move, this goes. And I believe Callinger meant it wholeheartedly. Now, shortly after this, Maria, the nurse, who's just come round to actually help out with the invalid grandma, she gets led down to the basement. Now, at that point, she is fighting. She's protesting. She's very upset. Frank said he wasn't able to actually see anything, but he assumed that he was hearing Maria getting raped. He said the furnace that was next to his head, it basically started up, but it drowned out most of the noise. But he could hear what he believed was Maria screaming. It turned out that everyone in the house could hear Maria scream. She was saying, "Help me, he's hurting me, I'm drowning." And that was followed by a gurgling sound, which is absolutely horrifying. Now, understandably, Edwina is listening to this. Bear in mind, her ties have not been done quite as effectively. And she thinks to herself, it's going to be my daughter and it's going to be me next. She gets up to her feet. She hobbles towards the front door, which must have been excruciatingly and extraordinarily terrifying. But she does it because she knows this is maybe her only chance to save the people she loves. And she gets away. She leaves that house screaming. Now, Michael Callinger, Callinger's son, he's screaming at this point, somebody's loose, because clearly he needs to let his father know, we are going to get caught unless we get out of here, because the police are going to be coming at some point. Now, as I've already noted, when Lucy saw Edwina, she called the police arrived. Lucy at this point tells the police that the reason she called them was a neighbour was screaming, she was hysterical. Edwina's saying to the police that two men with guns and knives were killing her family. That's the message that she gives them. And she says to them, please go in the house, please save my family. Bear in mind, the minute that you tell the police today and back then, it's the same measure, they are going to want backup, because the truth is, when they turn up, they don't know they're going to be able to overpower people who are actually armed and dangerous. So they get back up and then the police enter the home, and boy, it's a mess. There's smashed vases, there's items just all across the room, appliances with the cords were missing because obviously they'd used that to contain the victims. They then shout, come out with your hands up. At this point, understandably, the victims realise that the police are here, so they start to show themselves, and Retta crawls out from behind the sofa. She's then asked who else is in the home. She stuttered a single word, upstairs. At this point, she gets untied. She gets told, get out of the house. The police then go around the home and they find Randy, Dee Dee and Robert. They're all naked, but very fortunately, none of them are unharmed. Edwina's actions have miraculously and undoubtedly saved their lives. At this point, they're all untied, traumatized, but safe. Edwina then says to the police, there are also people in the basement. At this point, it turns out that for one individual, we don't get the same, shall we say, ending that means that they can go on to live a life where they can move past the trauma ideally and thrive. Where Maria is concerned, she got an ultimately different experience than the other women. So they find Maria slumped in the corner. She's dressed in her white clothes and they are literally bathed in blood. They notice immediately that her throat's been slashed from ear to ear. She's been stabbed in her back, in her throat, in her chest. Frank's actually unharmed. He's there, he's bound, but he's safe. But Maria going and knocking on that door at that point to go and look after the invalid grandma, for that, she has lost her life. And also the very fact that she was saying, I'm drowning, that will have been all the blood that will have been going into her lungs. It is just absolutely harrowing, the lack of air because she'd had a throat cut. Now, the police soon realise that the only people who aren't there still are the actual assailants. Now, like I said, aside from poor Maria, everyone else was unharmed. Most had been stripped, most had been taunted sexually, but for whatever bizarre reason, Maria hadn't been stripped and she hadn't been sexually molested in any way, but she had indeed been murdered. Now, the victims, they are fortunately able to provide really excellent descriptions of the Callingers, and the police are now on high alert to bring them in. Eva Rumi, a Leonia resident, she actually said that she'd been walking a dog and she'd seen a man and a teenage boy running into the park hand in hand, and just really stood out to them. Now, the man, he took off his coat. He also removes his shirt, he removes his tie, throws it on the ground. Then he bends forward and does something on the ground before he runs off. She then walks over to where the clothes had been left and she realises it's clear the guy had been washing his hands in a puddle, so he's trying to remove blood. The clothes that were left there, they were streaked with mud and patches of blood. So she tells the police, they go straight to the park, they examine the shirt and tie. Eva is also able to provide the police with a description of the pair of assailants, and that matches those that the victims have talked about. Now, the blood-stained shirt that's found, they analyse it, and details of a laundry mark and a manufacturer's label are circulated at this point. Also, a bus driver, he reports a man and a boy getting on his bus on the afternoon of the 8th of January, the crime plays out, and the driver said definitely this pair resembled the people that you are looking for. Also, they were running, they were in a hurry, there was just something a bit unusual about them. And then the police do a search of the area and they find multiple items. So they find a man's watch, a brown leather knife sheath, they find a knife and a revolver, and also some of Romaine's belongings. So clearly they are connected to the killers. And it also again speaks of disorganized chaos as far as committing the crime is concerned, because you do not want to leave all of that very incriminating information anywhere. Now, at this point, notices are sent out to police departments across the East Coast. They request information on crimes involving a man and a boy. So within days, multiple incidences are reported. So that first was the incident in Lindenwold, New Jersey. That was on the 22nd of November, 1974. Also attacks in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania on the 3rd of December, in Baltimore on the 10th of December, in Dumont, New Jersey on January the 6th. And every single incident had this common feature that it was a man and a boy, that they'd approached the residents using the ruse, do the Joneses live here? And every single victim also said there was something unusual about the way that the man smelt. There was something about the odour that was outside of their normal experience. Now, all of the victims were attacked at the front door and then they were forced inside. They were then tied up and they were robbed. Two of the victims were also sexually assaulted. So fingerprints are then taken from the homes of the other victims, and guess what? They matched the fingerprints from the Romaine house. But no matches are found at that point with the police department itself. So they've got them, but they can't match them with a particular perpetrator. Now, further examination of the laundry mark on the bloodstained shirt, however, comes up with the name Callinger. Now, police then search criminal records in the surrounding areas, but sadly, no match is found at this point. But details from the shirt that was found in the park, it ultimately is the reason why the pair get caught. And the reason for this is that good old detective work. They trace that the company who produces that shirt sold it through one retail outlet, Berg Brothers. It was a department store in Philadelphia. The police then interviewed staff in the store and they concluded that the shirt had been sold during autumn 1973. The police at this point assume that the purchaser was a resident in Philadelphia. So they ring the Philadelphia police and they say, have you got a record of a guy with the name Callinger or similar on your database? Now, the computer had previously drawn a blank on that because the spelling was different. But the Philadelphia officer recognised the name and also identified Joseph Callinger, who then had a police report there. So there was a record that they had on file for this guy, and all of a sudden they think, we've got our man. Now, the file on Joseph Callinger had his current address and photos. And guess what? The images matched exactly the descriptions of the attacker by the victims. Now, at this point, the police put a case together against Callinger, and they basically wanted to identify that the bloodstained shirt belonged to him. So they go ahead and they approach Joseph Felcher. Joseph Felcher owns Bright Sun Cleaners. He immediately said, this shirt belongs to Joseph Callinger. He immediately knew it was his. Why? Because of that distinctive smell. So this odour that Callinger is emanating is so powerful, it's so distinctive, it may as well be a signature. Now, photographs of Joseph Callinger and Michael are then sent to areas where their crimes were alleged to have taken place. All of those photos were affirmed positive IDs of Joseph Callinger and his son. Occasionally, there was some uncertainty about his son, Michael, but it was confirmed that even though Michael looked a lot like his younger brother, James, it was more likely to be Michael in those photographs. So on the 17th of January, police do arrest Joseph Callinger and two of his sons. So that was 13-year-old Michael, who's responsible, and 11-year-old James, because they look quite similar. So the police want to be sure that they've got the person who was responsible. Now, initially, as I've noted, they're unsure of which son is responsible. The two look so alike. But after they search the Callinger home, they do uncover multiple items that have been stolen from the homes of the victims. So without a doubt, they know that they have at least the right people, even if they haven't identified the two that are solely responsible. They know that Joseph Callinger is, but they have to figure out which son was with him during those events. So in 1975, Callinger is formally charged, and thank God, formally charged, because this guy would never have stopped. He's charged with the murder of Maria Fasching, he's charged with armed robbery, he's charged with wounding, kidnapping and theft and rape. After several hours of questioning, James Callinger, the poor boy, he's actually released. The police are satisfied that he had no involvement whatsoever. In the police station, Michael Callinger is then led for an interview, and they actually pass Joseph Callinger, who at this point says to his son, if you tell them anything, I'll kill you. I'm just going to throw it out there. As far as Callinger is concerned, he's not very sophisticated, is he? I mean, if you're in a scenario where you're trying to suggest that you're innocent, the last thing you're going to want to do is be like...
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Police are walking by with my son. Hang on a minute. I did want to carry on this interview, but I'm just going to say something. Son, yeah, Dad, if you tell these people anything, I'm going to kill you. Just doesn't look great, does it? Kind of looks like potentially a very violent, dangerous person, which he clearly is. Now, actually, that warning was powerful because Michael Callinger didn't say a word incriminating himself or indeed his father. So he certainly got that memo absolutely stained in his consciousness. It doesn't matter because they're bang to rights anyway. But the fact that the fear of Joseph Callinger as a father is so powerful that it means that Michael does exactly what he's told is demonstrative of the kind of dominance Callinger had in those children's lives. Now, one of the things that's very clear is that Joseph Callender does not come across as a typical human being, particularly when he's talking to the police. So he tells them that he orders his wife and daughter out of bed in the middle of the night to make him tea, sometimes as often as 30 or 40 times. That in itself would mean that they never slept. And I'm sure that he does sleep, therefore I would imagine that's an entire fabrication, a delusion of some sort. He also tells the police officers that he's actually built a bowling alley next to his bed and he practices bowling at night. Now, neither of these are true, obviously, but it demonstrates a mental instability to some degree. He tells psychologists that God had sent him to Earth on a, quote, divine mission. And that divine mission was to consist of helping people whose brains had malfunctioned because they wore badly designed shoes. Bear in mind, Callender is a shoemaker. I'm not quite clear how comfortable shoes are going to change any malfunctioned brain, but I do think that comfortable shoes are a life force. That's why 97% of the time I wear Uggs. They are ugly, but I don't care because they're very cosy. Nonetheless, this again is the delusion that he's peddling, at least to the officers. He also tells them that he'd been alive for 1,000 years. If I'm not chatting to people on a regular basis who are telling me that they've been around for 1,000 years, I don't know what I'm doing with my time. I do get it, you know. People read the Bible, for example, and talk about particular characters who've lived for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And I see that there are belief systems out there that would actually believe that to be the case. But Callender isn't one of those. Also, he says that most of the time, for those 1,000 years, he's been around in the form of a butterfly. Now, again, I think butterflies are beautiful. I look for them all the time. I kind of like to think that there's some kind of message from the spirit world by my dad, particularly Red Admirals. So I'm totally there with the idea of the spiritual connection. But I don't think that any butterfly lives for 1,000 years. I think their life cycle's pretty short. It's quite sad. He also says he had constantly been pursued by the devil. So there are some, what can we say, warning signs and red flags over where he is on a psychiatric level. Now, Joseph has a psychiatric evaluation. It concludes at this point that he is indeed competent to stand trial and that he does indeed know right from wrong. And we all know that the benchmark of that means that he is conscious of what's going on. It doesn't have to mean that he doesn't have these issues. It just means that he has to know that what he's done is incorrect. And that essentially means that he can go on the stand. Now, his first trial is for the charges of 4 counts of robbery, 4 counts of false imprisonment, and 1 count of burglary. Callender actually testifies at his own trial. He said that he had poor memory about things that had happened. There were periods that he genuinely couldn't remember. He said that God communicates with him, tells him what to do. He also goes so far as to say that he's actually the son of God, tells him that story about the fact that he used to be a butterfly. And it takes him less than an hour to go guilty of everything. Nice little narrative there, Callender. We enjoyed the whole idea of you being the son of God, and it did make it an interesting case to be on the jury of. But unfortunately, it doesn't deny what you did, so you're getting guilty. And he got quite a serious sentence, shall we say. It was 30 to 80 years in prison. Bear in mind, he's not been tried for murder at this point. Now, in September 1976, he then starts his trial in Hackensack, New Jersey. And this is for the horrific and brutal murder of Maria Fashing, and also for taking all the poor hostages in the Leonia home. Now, at this point, Callender has been diagnosed as paranoid and schizophrenic, and so he pleads not guilty by reason of insanity. During the trial, he does act out in ways that he hadn't done before, and a lot of people believe that this was just an act for the jury. He just wanted to seem insane. He would roll his eyes, he would shake his head, he kicked his feet, he threw his arms around, and he'd make these really weird sounds as well. And at times, the judge was so dismayed by the fact that this person was being really disruptive in his court that Judge Thomas Dalton literally removed him from the court. So that's how bad he was behaving. Now, the defence, they actually produced evidence that suggested Callender, because of his work as a shoe repairer, because he'd done this for many years, that had been inhaling the leather treatment that contained toluene. This is apparently a really dangerous chemical substance. It can numb the senses. It can also damage the brain. And we know that there have been substances out there that people have worked with all their lives that have essentially killed them. And it's heinous to know that these things played out and legitimately people were going to work not knowing that the thing that they were doing was going to ultimately take their life. But it doesn't explain how he was when he was a child. It doesn't explain when he was just making a hole in the wall so he could masturbate into it whilst also stabbing pictures that were pornographic. It doesn't sound like Callinger was very well even as a very young person, and certainly he was highly sadistic as a young person, and he wasn't a shoemaker then. Now, the evidence that was provided by the prosecution against Callinger was overwhelming. Any of us would have wanted to take this case because it's clear that he's guilty as hell. It took just 2 hours of deliberation. Then the jury found him guilty for the Leonia murder and also the hostage situation. He was then sentenced to life in prison, and rightfully so. He's a very dangerous human being. Now, his 13-year-old son, Michael Callinger, who's clearly a victim as well in this case, he did plead guilty to 2 counts of armed robbery. That was in exchange for dropping the murder charge, which I believe is fair enough because he wasn't the person directly murdering the individual who sadly lost her life. And this boy is also a child. Even though he's an evil teenager in his actions, it's under the coercion of his father, so I think it's appropriate that he's not charged with murder. He was then deemed by the courts to have been under the control and influence of his father at the time of the offences. He's sent to a reformatory and he was released into the care of foster parents and was then placed on probation until his 25th birthday. Apparently he then changed his name and he moved to another state, and we can only hope that the scars and the trauma of being brought up by such a brutal human being and such a treacherous individual will be something that he has managed to overcome, because it could be that he himself has got some scars that then affect other human beings. Now, during Callinger's time in prison, he was not an ideal candidate to, shall we say, impress the governor of that prison, because he doesn't like towing the line. First of all, you know that penchant for fire? Yeah, it doesn't end. In 1977, he actually sets himself on fire. So he uses that pyromania and the suicidal ideation and connects them both. He also assaults an inmate and starts a fire in the cell block. We get to 1978, is then moved to a hospital in Pennsylvania for the criminally insane because his actions are deeply disturbing and they don't know how to manage him in the ordinary population.
I was going to murder my own family and then take my own life and become God.
What do you think of the death penalty?
I'm opposed to it.
The state has no right to take your life, but you can murder other people?
I don't think anyone has the right to take a life.
Except you?
When I'm under hallucination, I do.
These voices from God, these hallucinations, do you still experience them?
Yes, I do.
Often?
Often.
Do you ever feel violent?
Yes, I do.
What do you feel like doing?
Killing people.
You still feel like killing people?
Yes.
Describe the feeling that you get when you feel like killing people.
Well, last March 11th, I was hallucinating, and I took a razor blade and I cut a man's throat.
Here in the hospital?
Here in the hospital.
Do you think you'd murder me, Joe?
Yes.
That's gruesome, Joe. That's horrible.
Yes, it is.
And you don't blame me if I say I hope you never get out of this place.
I hope I never do either.
He then tries to kill another prisoner. Totally unprovoked attack. He slashes another inmate's throat. Now, they did survive the attack, but they're very lucky to survive their attack. Maria didn't. 6 years later, he's then visited and interviewed by the author Flora Rita Schreiber, and they actually wrote the book together, The Shoemaker. Obviously, that writer was very interested in hearing his side of the story. Now, during the interviews, Callinger actually tells him about the visions that controlled him, that he blames, shall we say, for making him perform evil tasks. They included the 2 murders in 1974. He admitted to the mutilation and murder of Jose Collazo and the drowning of his own son, Joey. So she gets this extra information that essentially explains other deaths. And The Shoemaker, the book, actually portrays Callinger as this unloved adopted child who grows up in this environment where he's created. So the tormented killers driven to these psychotic beliefs because he's had such a horrible start to life. And there's a bit of you that goes, okay, we understand that trauma certainly seems to play into serial killers' backgrounds on the whole. And we all feel absolutely sorry for children who are brought up in these really hostile, abusive scenarios because it's just wrong. But can we all agree that the vast majority, and we're talking about the high 90% here, don't become violent offenders or killers? Actually, they become quite the contrary. Couldn't it just be that certain individuals are born with a predisposition to harm? And then, yes, you have these activation factors, such as a terrible environment, an abandoning parent, and all the things that go with it, that then activate the potential further. So you're always going to be a pretty negative human being, but more negative as each impact hits you. Because without a shadow of a doubt, you can't say his childhood is why he went on to do the most horrendous things to strangers and to his own children. He killed one of his own children for money. Didn't get it, but was happy to do it, to try to. So I think that she's being, shall we say, oversensitive to his needs as opposed to seeing him as he truly is. We get to January 1984, and at this point he is convicted of those other murders. He's sentenced to 2 life terms to be served consecutively after his other sentences. He's never going to walk the streets again. It's as simple as that. Now, at 1988, this is when he's 42, he gets involved with some television interviews, and these are infamous now. During the interviews, he's basically continuing his desire to slaughter every person on earth. He also...
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Expresses his desire to commit suicide. These days we'd say die by suicide because it's not illegal, but back then it was. You could actually be put in prison for trying to take your own life. But he said that he needed to take his own life only to become God. He's also hyper destructive to himself in prison. So for example, in 1990 they do an x-ray and it reveals that he's collected these metal objects and ate them. So he has all these metal objects in his digestive system. His attorney at the time said that he'd basically been swallowing the objects since the mid-August of that year. And the whole premise of this was he wanted to kill himself. And he continued that practice because he wanted to find a way out of the prison situation. He wanted to die. And maybe the delusion that's telling him, if you die, you're going to be God. Maybe that is why he's so intent on doing it. He also tries to starve himself. He constantly gets into fights. He's tying rubber bands around his wrist because he thinks that might cut off his circulation. And then we get to 1996, and at this point he does actually die. So he's 59 and he actually has a seizure. He'd spent his last 5 years under suicide watch. So they really thought he was a serious risk to himself. And undoubtedly, if he's eating all these metal objects, if he's starving himself on a physiological level, his body's going to be under intense stress. Add to that the medication. I mean, it's clear in the interviews that you watch with him, this guy is heavily, heavily medicated. And those medications could have really problematic side effects in the long term. So a culmination of all of those things, as well as attitude, because he blatantly doesn't want to be here, seems to culminate in his death. Now, following his death, a lot of people celebrated, I'm going to be honest. The victims who were put through the ordeals, they were not sad to hear that this man was no longer taking breath. And Maria Fasching's sister, who obviously has had to live knowing the way that her sister died in the most brutal of ways, she said, "The world is just a little better place now that he's dead. But we as a family suffer to this day. We will never stop suffering." It is very hard in these cases to find any shred of empathy for somebody that I'm describing. Genuinely, it is really hard to have any connection of empathy with a man who went out of his way to cause such havoc and to harm so horrendously. I mean, the amount of people that this man really badly affected in the long term of their lives surviving the trauma is enough. But to imagine that he killed children, to imagine he killed his own child, and to imagine that he doesn't show any real remorse for it. He understands at the end of his life and during his incarceration that what he did was terrible, but I don't think there's a connection emotionally there because I genuinely don't think he has it. He's devoid of it. And when you look back at those early years, 100%, we can all feel an absolute sadness that any child is brought into this world and treated so awfully. And those adoptive parents should, in my opinion, have served sentences themselves. But the idea that that makes him the killer, I just don't buy into it. I genuinely think that Mother Nature creates predators, and those predators sometimes act on those urges, And this man, combined with his mental health struggles, although that would not be a reason for him to become the killer, but certainly the mental health issues would have exacerbated actions in certain situations where he was disorganized and where there was an escalation because of the chaos he was feeling in his head. But it's the killer within him that makes him the danger to our society. And I think that Maria's sister's right. The world is certainly a safer place when people like him are no longer walking its plane. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.